One insert above that might be made under Countersport during the war. If one is looking for something to buy, buy timberland. And that was the business of the company, timberland, and converting timber into chemicals and charcoal. I took advantage of the extremely low prices that at which it was available in those years, because everybody was thinking of everything except timberland, woodland. And I bought land as low as still covered with trees of 50 years growth for as low as a couple of dollars an acre, which of course escalated to greater value. During the war, then I took off the wood for the great chemical company, or rather contracted for them to take it off. And then when the war was over, I felt that I didn't want to wait 50 years for the land to produce another crop, which it would do without any reseeding under the conservatory system of woodland operation, which I used. So I sold the land to West Virginia Pulp and Paper Company. Unfortunately, while I did make a good profit, I would have made at least several times more profit if I had kept that land from 1952 or 3 or 4 when I did sell it to the present time. That can be inserted above.
When you had your graduate students working, doing their work out in the field, so to speak, in these companies, did you have contact with their supervisors within the company?
Oh, yes. These might well have been companies, at least the two or three that I can think of, were always, when they were remote from New York City and when I couldn't visit them, they were always with companies which I had good friends and associates or friendly or former students, and so I could keep good track of what was going on.
What companies were those?
Oh, yes, one was named the Northwood Chemical Company, where my good student, Dr. Katzen, worked. Another was the Vulcan Engineering Company in Cincinnati. Another was in Cleveland, the name of which I can't think at the moment. A Diamond Alkali Company.
Oh, yeah.
Diamond Alkali Company, which has since become Diamond Shamrock. American Cyanamid was another one. They had a laboratory not so far away.
You said that your undergraduates were doing work that was publishable. What were your laboratory facilities like in from 32 on when you first arrived?
They were deplorably low. We did not have the instrumentation and other facilities, of course, that are available now. On the other hand, research didn't seem to be as expensive then as it has become now, as the frontiers of science and research have carried on. We require more and more complicated instrumentation. So we really operated with a very low budget and very little equipment. We improvised, but fortunately, we always had one or two mechanics in the laboratory, and we built much of the equipment that was needed. And as I say, the instrumentation was, in other cases, woefully inadequate. But we made do. In case, on some occasions, we borrowed instruments from other sources, other companies, and so on, where the students were working or otherwise.
There was a 5-year period, 32 to 37. You became chairman in 37.
Yes.
How did the department change in that 5-year period?
Oh, well, we changed the curriculum, of course, almost entirely during that time. Priorly, it had been very qualitative and descriptive with regard to chemical manufacturing processes as they were used, rather than the science of chemical engineering devoted to the determination of the quantitative factor of the operations, heat transfer, evaporation, mass transfer, diffusion, and etc., which are the controlling phenomena of the operations, also reaction velocities and so on. We were able to do several rather good theses and research with rather simple equipment, one of which I remember was determination of the reaction rates for the esterification of some alcohols and acids in distilling columns, where we were able to design and operate distilling columns where the analysis could be made on each plate of the vapor and the liquid and the temperature, and then in such a case as the esterification of butanol with acetic acid, we were able to determine the kinetics of the reaction simultaneously with the rate of removal of one or more of the components in the distillation system by the vapor-liquid equilibria which pertain. That now I'm talking about was with regard to the research. With regard to the curricula itself, we did quantify and put in more theory and less of the qualitative manufacturing operations in the coursework. This we were fortunate also in those years to be able to obtain the services of top-notch engineers in the design companies like Lummis, Foster Wheeler, and others to come in as adjunct professors and teach our graduate students courses in particular phases of plant design, heat transfer, and other phases of chemical engineering.
When you became chairman in 37, what did you see as the immediate needs of the department? Well, let me, before we look at that, what were the circumstances around your becoming chairman? 37.
Well, I came in, as said before, 1932. Dr. Olson was then 60 years old, so all I had to do was look at the calendar and think that it was any reasonable progress, I would follow along his footsteps and become chairman within half a dozen or thereabouts years. And of course, he aged at the normal rate. So did I, of course, only I learned, of course, very much in those years with regard to the problems of education, and also, of course, with regard to chemical engineering, because I continued my consulting work, as I mentioned, with Gray Chemical, to whom I licensed the process that they used, also to Eastman Kodak, or Tennessee Eastman, to whom I licensed the processes which they used for refining millions of pounds a day of acetic acid, or removing millions of pounds of water therefrom. Also, in those years, I worked with Hercules Powder Company and with several other major commercial solvents and other chemical companies. Also, had one or two jobs with Exxon. Then it was Standard Oil of New Jersey. So that I had a opportunity of learning many aspects of the practical or industrial application of chemical engineering principles.
Now let me come back to when you became chairman. What did you see? What was your agenda as the new department chairman?
Well, actually, this in 37, there was not. But by that time, I had already changed the curriculum about as much as I wanted, and I don't remember any abrupt changes that had to be made in the curriculum or in the activities. It so happened that that same year we had a very disastrous fire at the Polytechnic. It burned off the whole top floor. I hadn't mentioned this before.
No.
This was in early spring, a cold day, cold morning, as I remember, my office on the fifth floor. Did I talk about my office before?
No.
I'll come back to that. My office on the fifth floor, and about 20 after 9 in the morning, the fire gong sounded, and I ran out and did look out my window and see smoke rising from another wing of the building I was in. I had a fire escape nearby and was not at all terrified, and as a matter of fact started to take the drawers out of my file of papers and correspondence, etc., and carry them down the back fire escape, which was five floors of very, very difficult maneuvering. I didn't get very far, and I pretty soon realized the fire was not going to hurt my particular office, as it did not. However, the whole floor, the whole roof burned off this building, which may have had 20,000 square feet, possibly that's too much, area. And later, a temporary roof had to be built below what had been the original roof. So for two years, while we were building a new roof, we were most uncomfortable. We had a faculty meeting right after noon, and the President Rogers discussed the matter with us, and by taking inventory, we found that while there had been considerable damage to equipment, to laboratory facilities, to some instrumentation, and to the roof, to my own laboratory, which had a 30-foot ceiling, top floor, a pitched roof, and then above the ceiling, an attic, where I had stored various materials and also had a water tank to supply constant pressure, et cetera, et cetera. The president, Rogers, a great man in my estimation, told the faculty, or found out from the faculty, that no valuable papers had been lost. That is, no manuscripts or no nothing of that nature that would be impossible to replace. None of the no real offices. Well, there were only one other professor had an office on that floor, and none of the other floors had anything more than water damage. He read a telegram then from the president of Rensselaer Polytechnic, offering condolences and sympathy, and saying that if there was anything they Rensselaer could do, they would be very glad to do so. And the president Rogers, who had come a year after I did and was not an old timer, said that he had checked why this telegram came from this particular school and found that in the late 90s the main building of Rensselaer Polytechnic had burned, and at that time there was a discussion of uniting Polytechnic with Rensselaer because they had lost almost their entire facility. This, however, had not been taken advantage of by Rensselaer, and because they wanted to stay where they were, obviously, and it was only a tit for a tat some 40 years later. The funny thing of this fire was that it had started in the attic over a chemistry laboratory, and of course everybody first blamed the chemistry laboratory for its noxious use of chemicals. However, this was an analytic laboratory. Also, it was a Monday morning, and there had been no classes since the preceding Friday, so the chemistry department got out of it rather easily. Then came the electrical engineering department, because that part, that laboratory, had been rewired by one of the electrical engineering professors. This, keep in mind, was still during the Great Depression, when everybody was doing anything to earn a nickel, and he had rewired that laboratory the preceding summer in his spare time, Professor Whipple. Inspection showed nothing could have occurred from the very point where it started. Then, of course, since the chemical engineering had the adjoining laboratory, we jumped on us. Our attic, however, was entirely safe. We never stored anything up there except dust. And so we got off the hook. Nobody ever announced publicly what had been the cause, but it was ultimately decided by all that the fire itself had started due to the president's occupancy. He had a fireplace in his old office, and the building which the fire was in was 85, which was adjacent to 99 Livingston. The fireplace chimney was an old flue that had been in the original building and then continued on up through the partition wall of the newer building, which had been built in 1893. And that morning, the superintendent of buildings, who had a little office next to the president, came in and fired up the president's office before he got there to give a cheerful light, and fired it with cannel coal, which has a fair amount of volatile matter. And what had happened was it evidently had set the accumulation of 100 years and more of soot in the chimney on fire, and that had in turn heated some place where it had burned out the old mortar. The chimney had been built before the days of fire clay liners, and so this chimney fire had started in a beam, evidently, which rested too close to the flue in the masonry of this old chimney. We never had a public chance to laugh at the president in his search for the for what had happened, but it was general knowledge. I interrupted something, some train of thought there.
Well, you were also going to talk about your office.
Oh.
Talk about the fire.
Oh, this may go back farther somewhere. Let's turn it off a second. We were talking about my early days at Poly and what Poly was like in the early 30s. Some of this is well described, if I may be conceited enough to use the word well described, in notes which I and remarks which I had given at a luncheon celebrating the golden anniversary of doctorates in chemistry at Poly, and which I gave on November 23rd, 1985. I will at this point edit a typescript copy of this that I have for inserting in so much as you may wish to insert in the transcript notes.
Okay, that'll be excellent.
Yeah.
Is there anything in
this
there you care to elaborate on?
Wait a minute. This also discusses in it the start of the Kirk-Othmer Encyclopedia, and that's is on starts in the bottom of page 10, and goes on for the next two or three pages. And in my editing, I will see whether there's anything that I think should be added there. Or removed from this for the present purposes. It in general was also a light-hearted discussion of the situation at Poly in the early days when I came in here and for the next 8 years. Oh.
That's the last page.
That's the last page. Yes, I saw 71. I was wondering. Cut it out and let's think a second. Addendum to this note, and this was primarily a celebration of the chemistry department as to when their first doctorate was given in 1935. To a man by the name of Goldberger, who unfortunately had had a very bad accident in his thesis research experiments, and also one of his associates, who was working for a master's degree, was also injured. In chemical engineering, we give a doctorate degree the second 2 years later to a man who studied the microphotographs of cross sections of catalysts that were used in sulfuric acid manufacture. He did this work under Dr. Olson. The next second doctorate man, I remember Joel Vetter. I remember I knew him better, and I, as an indication of the type of students and the work load which they were carrying, I looked him up when he was coming up for his doctorate degree. This was about 1940. I put a question mark, and I'll check that. In looking at his record in the registrar's office, I found that he had come to Poly in the evening school in 1918. He was working in a chemical plant in New Jersey and had to commute, of course, over for evening work. He had not completed the necessary prerequisites for a bachelor's degree, so he had to take, I think, some mathematics equivalent to high school math. He then took, over a period of 8 or 9 years, the courses for his bachelor's degree in the evening, in the late 20s, in the late 20s, he was finishing off his work, and I think he got his bachelor's degree about the year I came to Poly. He then worked year after year on his master's and then his doctor's thesis and work, and ultimately getting it, as I remember, about 1940 period. Meanwhile, he had become the manager of the Mutual Chemical Company in Hackensack or some one of the towns on the Jersey coast. And in his spare time, he was an astronomer. With a very practical mechanical mind, he ground a 11 or 12 inch lens mirror for a reflecting telescope, and gave the mirror, the telescope, and some money to install it to one of the parks over in New Jersey. Joe Vetter was a very hard worker, and he did all of this work with a minimum of visual ability. That is, he always had to wear very heavy glasses, and his eyes were a long way from being 20/20.